The following program contains views and opinions that do not necessarily reflect those of KMRE staff or of the Spark Museum of Electrical Invention.
It's Cascadia News Now. I'm Stephanie Contouris in the KMRE studio with co-hosts Cascadia Weekly's Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham. Coming up, State Senate candidate Pinky Vargas is going to give us her take on key issues in the legislative session. But first, we welcome Rosalinda Guillen, who was kind enough to stop by and give us a quick update. She's the founder of Community to Community Development, one of the hosts of Community Voice on KMRE. And Rosalinda, let's just remind people what happened with the Labor and Industries report that just came out saying that Sarbanon Farms was not negligent in the death of Ernesto Silva Ibarra.
That's right. We were in a meeting. Actually, Labor and Industries investigators came to our offices, Community to Communities offices, on February 1st and personally gave us the news, which was infuriating for us to have them give us this response to their investigation that they started, last August. And so this is the first investigation that's been finished or that's been completed. We still have Employment Security Department and, you know, the Federal Department of Labor, which we don't expect to ever hear anything from. But it's very disappointing, not only the results of the investigation, but their process. Their process seems so convoluted, and also the criteria that they use to determine whether a worker's death was caused by the employer, and the way they isolate and they silo different questions and answers from those questions so that they don't all link up. Like, for example, the health and safety of a farm worker, the rest breaks, the amount of food that they were getting, the number of hours that they were working is not linked to whether the farm worker died because of those causes or not.
I mean, well, that's something I didn't understand. When they said, so to remind people, if they didn't know, Ernesto Silva Ibarra died last August when we were in a smoke-filled county because of the wildfires from BC. It was 90-plus degrees in Sumas, and they were not given breaks. They were not given lunchtimes, which Elle and I agreed, but they say, well, he died from natural causes.
Exactly.
And Sarbanon is not responsible. How could you even prove that Sarbanon?
And I think that's the issue in the way that there's several things here. One is a structural issue of the way that Labor and Industries conducts their investigations, but then the way that they take the information they get from the investigations and lay it out to prove a case. So it's very true. And the other thing that everybody should remember is that during that time when the smokes were drifting over Whatcom County was also peak blueberry harvest season. So while we were being told by health officials, stay inside, the smoke is bad, right? They were pushing the workers out of the labor camp that they were living in and keeping them out there 12, 14 hours a day picking blueberries at the fastest pace that they could get. I mean, it's just totally the opposite of how one group of people on a farm can be treated that way by their employer during this public crisis, public health crisis for everybody. And Labor and Industry goes in later to investigate what happened during that period of time and says there's no problem, you know, that the worker died of natural causes. At the same time that the Labor and Industries knew this because they were there at the encampment where the workers were, and they saw the effects of the overwork, the extreme dehydration the works were suffering from. They saw the infected feet, hands, the half-paralyzed faces of the workers. You know, the workers just laying there with these extreme migraines from dehydration, but also the air quality that they had been exposed to all these weeks. We were running them back and forth to clinics, and they were there supposedly interviewing the workers. But now all of these interviews, they gave us these convoluted answers about why those actually don't fit under the criteria that they needed to prove that the company caused his death.
Well, I'm fascinated by this idea that you put forward about siloing of data and information so that a conclusion in one area can't be extrapolated and delivered over to another. Well, I guess my question for you is, do you believe that's by accident or by design?
No, I think it's by design. I think that this has been done by design. I think that the agricultural industry, the corporate agricultural industry, for many years has had an incredible political influence in our legislature. We as farm workers, and in this case clearly shows that, our lack of resources and ability to fight at that level after many years of this structure being put in place. This structure was set in place a long time ago, and it has been functioning that way. This is why if you ask any farm worker what they think of labor and industry, they will immediately say labor and industries works for the employers. Why are we going to trust to go to them, and why are we going to trust that they're actually going to do anything to support us when we complain about health and safety issues? And so it's been common. There have been many complaints, lawsuits, in trying to get labor and industries to actually do an equitable job with these problems, with worker safety problems. So I think that it's structural, right? Which is on Farm Worker Tribunal Day this last Monday, I can't believe it's just a couple of days ago, we talked to the governor about this. We talked to other state agencies, and we actually said to the governor.
I'm sorry, what is Farm Worker Tribunal Day, in case people don't know?
The Farm Worker Tribunal is something community to community started 5 years ago because of these structural issues, right? Farm workers don't get the chance or the opportunity to actually speak about the issues that's happening to them. So we raise the funds, and we go to Olympia with impacted farm workers, and we set up a space where they give testimony of what's happening in the agricultural industry now. This year, the focus was on H-2A because of all of the strikes, so, and all of the issues in H-2A. So after Ernesto Silva died and the workers at SUMAS walked out, there were workers walking out in Quincy, in Pasco, in Brewster. There were five walkouts in Eastern Washington after the walkout here because they were suffering the same issues. They weren't getting paid. The food was bad. They were sick. The abuse was horrific. And so they called the Farm Worker Union, Familias Unidas por la Justicia, and said, help. And, you know, we supported Ramon and his organizers to go and talk to the workers. So this is not an isolated incident. It's a miracle, I believe, that there's only been one death that has been exposed in this way. These kinds of issues with H-2A workers are rampant all over the state. But let me just say that it was infuriating to us to hear the decision. So the decision that the farm was not negligent because of the siloing of this information. To us, it's clear the farm is negligent, right? Then they fined the farm for violations of break periods and lunch periods. They fined the farm, and they were like, this is a precedent-setting fine. $149,796. Never before have we fined anybody this much, right? And then they say, but because of the cooperation of the management, because they were so cooperative and so open with us, we cut the fine in half. It's like,
oh, I hadn't heard that part. I knew about the fine. I hadn't heard they cut it in half.
They cut it in half. They reduced it in half.
For the farm's good behavior?
Because of the farm's cooperation at the time that the investigator showed up. Well.
Can you unpack H2A a little bit, and what is that, and why is it important in this case?
H2A is a federal labor program that gives agricultural corporations the ability to be able to go to another country and contract workers and bring them into the United States with a special work visa. And the farms are supposed to be responsible for all the travel costs, all the living expenses, housing, food, and, you know, everything that the work and medical care, everything that the workers need here. But it gives them the ability to be able to do that. And over the years, because of the lack of, comprehensive immigration reform, it's been easier for workers in some cases to come to work in the United States under this program. And it requires many times a farm labor contractor, because applying for these workers is not that easy, and it's not meant to be easy. It's supposed to be an emergency type program where if there's definitely a worker shortage, then you can go and apply for them. But we think that, you know, farm labor contractors like Dan Fazio and the Washington Farm Labor Association has manipulated this whole program to make money off of bringing these workers in. And farms have found it easier to use him to go to Mexico, recruit workers, and bring them over here. So last year in Washington State, there were over 18,000 guest workers that were brought in statewide, and it's grown. Every year it grows and grows. We expect it to be over 26,000 workers this year. It's displacing local farm workers, but besides that, what the farm workers worry about is exactly what happened here. That you're a farm worker that has worked in this area all your life, probably maybe two or three generations, and you're watching your fellow Mexican brothers being treated in this way, literally almost living in a prison camp.
Right.
You observe that in your own backyard. It's horrific for us to see that.
And this particular company in Sumas, they also have farms in California, and so in a sense, they have their own private migratory labor force that they're able to shift around from place to place.
Yes.
And in the doing so, displace actual workers in Whatcom County.
Which is a whole other issue that Whatcom County needs to look at. That this is, Sarbanan is owned by the parent company's Munger Farms based in Delano, California. They came, I don't know how, they came to Whatcom County and they purchased 1,500 acres of good agricultural land that belonged to, I think, three dairy farms that were, you know, they were aging out and they couldn't continue with the dairy. But they purchased 1,500 acres of good land and then planted blueberries. So you're talking mono agriculture.
Monoculture, right.
Monoculture, not organic. So you immediately increase the number of chemicals that you're putting into the land. And there have been two big fines from the state on this company actually dirtying the waters, right? There was one where there was sewage. There was another type of runoff that were, that goes into the creeks, which goes, we don't want our salmon killed in this area. But this company has been fined
for a lot.
A lot of money for not taking care of the land.
Right.
And so here's an outside corporation. They not only are destroying the land, but then they bring in slave labor.
Right.
How can that happen in Whatcom County? That's my big question.
So I, you know, anytime you look at federal and state labor laws, anytime there's a basic right or protection, it comes with the phrase non-agricultural workers. What can we do about that? What can, you know, people do who are listening to this do to start extending some basic rights to farm workers?
I think that as people who live in Whatcom County, we have a right to look at our food system and to look at our land and protect our local food system. It doesn't, you know, a person died. Ernesto Silva was 28 years old, two children in Mexico. And you should have seen all these other young men, right? They're coming from Mexico. They all have, they're desperate to make a little bit of money. But a person died in our own backyard. And so when you look at laws, you look at regulations, it's like, really, is that all a life is worth? Is like, how are we going to look at these laws? I think that we have a moral obligation to have a discussion with the county council, especially, and the county executive about how can this happen? We know that there are other corporate interests coming into Whatcom County, buying up land, local farmland, and farming it. We've got lots of absentee farms, in absentee farmers, you know, that they just hire managers. And this has got to be looked at. We asked the governor of Washington State, Governor Inslee, to create a task force that has some kind of authority to literally dissect this program, to look at every aspect of it and its impact on farmworker families in Washington State, and then to backtrack from there and say, how are we going to manage? And I said to Governor Inslee, you as our governor, whatever the laws are, you have a moral responsibility to us to create a political buffer against the Trump administration for what they're trying to do right now.
And I just wanted to say, we are going to actually do an entire show on these issues, Dave, in part to answer your question next week. And Rosalind is coming back with Michelle Stelovich from the Northwest Washington Labor Council.
Yeah.
And we're going to devote an entire show because it's not something we can unpack in 10 minutes or so. But to answer your question more directly, Rosalinda also wanted to talk about what is happening with an event coming up.
That's right.
Thursday. No Way to Treat a Guest Worker. Tell us quickly about
No Way to Treat a Guest. actually is what it is. Okay. But we are on February 15th, we're having a community forum, and we're really excited because Adrienne DeVartinian from Farm Worker Justice, who is an expert on the guest worker program, who is in Washington, D.C., and is observing the current political happenings around this guest worker program, is going to be our featured speaker. And that is the place for everybody to go and really understand the history and the legalities of this program and also what can be done, right? But I mean, I think we all have a moral obligation to really understand that. And I just want to ask our audience out there, don't read the false information that's being printed by the Bellingham Herald. I mean, I just can't believe the Bellingham Herald just said the headline, right? Farm found not negligent. It's like, it's coming out over, and this company has got a PR machine now to try to paint themselves as innocent. Do not believe this Trump-like false information that's being fed to everybody about this decision. This is a false decision. The worker was killed by the company, and we will hold them accountable. So please, call us at Community to Community. Go to the forum on the 15th and ask us questions.
Okay, and that forum, again, it's No Way to Treat a Guest. It is Thursday, February 15th at 6 p.m., and that's happening at the Bellingham Unitarian Fellowship. We will be posting that on our link and on our Facebook page. Rosalinda Guillen, who is the founder of Community to Community Development, one of the hosts of our own show, Community Voice, Saturday at noon, Sunday at 8 a.m., Thursday at 7 a.m. Rosalinda, thank you so much.
Thanks. Thanks for the time. Community to Community Development is your local grassroots organization led by women, people of color, and farm workers.
Comunidad a Comunidad es su organización local de base que es liderada por mujeres, personas de color, y campesinos.
If you care about the food that you eat and having a fair and sustainable food system, you should partner with us.
Si le importa la comida que comemos y quiere mejorar el sistema alimentario, debería juntarse con nosotros.
You can call us at 360-738-0893 or you can find us on the Facebook.
Puede comunicarse con nosotros por teléfono 360-738-0893 o encontrarnos en nuestra página de Facebook.
And you're listening to Cascadia News Now on KMRE and KAVZ in Deming and Van Zandt. I'm Stephanie Contouris. With me, Dave Willingham and Tim Johnson. And we're very honored to have our recently declared state Senate candidate, Pinky Vargas. And she is running, is declared to run against Doug Erickson in the 42nd District, which is a large chunk of Whatcom, almost all of Whatcom. I do want to clarify, Pinky is here tonight as a candidate. We are going to discuss legislative issues with candidate Pinky. Perhaps we will have Pinky in another hat at another time. Pinky, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
It's been quite a roller coaster legislative session, and we have a lot of bills to talk about, but I am going to throw the floor to you and see what's spoken to you in the past week.
Oh, boy. It has been exciting. You're right. I think some big things have been the Hearst decision. Also watching some things that are basic civil rights issues and how we're taking care of the people who live in Whatcom County and the people who live in the state. Just recently, last week, Doug Erickson voted against a breakfast after the bell bill, which would feed children with low income and make sure that they get fed in our schools. So, he is staying on course, and a course that I hope to change.
Well, and I'm sure that you must be pretty passionate about some of the reproductive bills that have passed, such as the Reproductive Parity Act, which has been around for at least 5 or 6 years. I remember when it was first introduced. One of the things the Reproductive Parity Act does is mandates that any insurance provider in Washington state, if they provide any kind of maternal care, that they have to also provide the ability for choice and abortions. But it has expanded, and this is the part that's exciting to me, it mandates contraception coverage from employers.
which I think is fantastic. You know, particularly I think for people who are have low income challenges, is we are trying to control the things that are happening with our body, and without those, without prescriptions, we don't always have that option. And to make it unavailable for people just because they can't afford it, that's not right.
Well, Pinky, I have two questions for you. The first one is that running for the legislature is a very difficult and thankless thing to do. The job itself is difficult and thankless. Why are you doing this?
Well, I'm doing it for, you know, I mean, I can tell you, you know, why I'm running for the Senate, because I want us to move forward, and I want to work on common interests and start helping our communities. And really, opportunity needs to come from for everyone in Whatcom County, and I think that that's what we're lacking. And you know what? Being a politician and elected official used to be an honorable job, and I really think that there's a place that we need to return to in regards to having these positions, and realize they are a privilege, and it is an honor to serve, and I'm hoping I can bring that.
Well, let me jump up really quickly with a follow-up. I hear you about the importance of serving and how hard people have to work, and I know that's something you care about. You cared about it a lot because you just recently ran for re-election at City Council, so let's just get that right out there. You did just win another term at City Council. Why are you jumping to state?
Well, I think that the more you get involved, the more that you see how many issues are connected. When you see at a local level that things are stopped at a state level and or at a federal level, you start to see where kind of the crux of some of the challenges that you have are. And particularly at the end of last year when the capital budget didn't go through, and I could see all of the things that Whatcom County was being affected because we weren't getting that money, it kind of gets under your skin a little bit. And you're like, okay, hey, somebody's got to fix this. And usually when I have that feeling, that somebody usually ends up being me.
Well, my follow-up question was, I'd just like to get a comment from you about the representation in the 42nd district as it's been in the last several years in the Senate position. And obviously you don't think that's adequate, otherwise you would not be running for this position. What's your take on representation, and how would you approach that differently?
Well, I can tell you, this morning alone, I met with a group of people who told me that they have tried to meet their organization with Senator Erickson for 8 years, and they have never, ever been able to give him, or he's never given them any time. And to me, that seems disgraceful, because you should be able to talk to all of the people that you're representing. Whatever your views are, you should be able to hear both sides of the story. And that's something that's really important to me. I'm from a really big family, and we have lots of robust conversation around both sides of the story. And I think that that should be part of who you are as a representative. And I don't think Senator Erickson, I think he cherry picks who he talks to and the organizations he's willing to hear out.
So you mentioned the Hearst fix, and you know, I'd like to get your thoughts on, you know, it was signed by the governor a couple weeks ago. How do you feel about the fix that we got for that situation?
Well, it's obviously not perfect. Not everybody got what they want, but it was limiting building development. It put everyone on hold, and I think it really made a lot of discomfort. What are we going to do? So I'm glad that the legislature was able to act on a reasonable bill. I think that we could have looked a little bit more around what are the long-term effects, but there was some good things in there, which included $300 million in investments for water conservation projects and fishery restoration to support our environment and fisheries and water. So I think that what it does is it allows people now we know what's happening. Is it perfect? Do we have room for improvement? Absolutely.
And can you just recap for those of us who haven't been following Hearst, what the compromise kind of was?
Well, you know, in regards to how people will still be allowed to do individual wells on their property. And I don't have the numbers in front of me, but I believe it was 5,000 gallons a day. I'd have to check on that. It's either 3 or 5,000 gallons. So they are going to be exempt from that, and they don't have to put meters on their wells. And I think those are some of the things that people were really concerned on. So, but how we're actually talking about what our aquifers are, what water we actually have underneath the ground. And if you listen to the town hall of the 42nd on Monday, Senator Erickson said, well, we have lots of water in Whatcom County because it's raining right now. And to me, that's just, it's really looking at this in a very narrow picture. And really, we need to look long term. We have to look at what's underneath the ground, because that's what we're talking about here.
Let me just say, KMRE, and on our show last week, if you listened, you heard that we aired pretty much all of the 40th LD Town Hall. We tried to do that for the 42nd. And I want to give a shout out to Luann Van Werven's L.A. Brian, who did his level best to get us that audio. Turns out that the Republican Party does not tape their town halls anymore, so we aren't able to bring you any of the 42nd town hall.
So you talked about, you know, the Hearst fix being a reasonable fix. Would you look at changing that? Would you, you know, because the $300 million and stuff, that's down the road.
Right.
What would you, are you happy with that? Would you want to alter that?
You know what, Dave? I will tell you, I am not the professional on this, and I think that I would need to sit with, what did they talk about? What was off the table? What's on the table? And in order to make that decision, I'd need to know that information. So I don't know what was discussed in length, and so I would need to look at that before I could answer that question.
Well, Pinky, you have a unique experience being on a municipal city council, Bellingham City Council. And I know that for years, Bellingham City Council has asked things of the legislature. Sometimes you get them, sometimes you don't. Maybe you can talk about that legislative function from a municipal standpoint. I mean, cities are asking Olympia for things. Is Olympia responsive to those requests? And how would you approach those requests?
I would say that we've had limited response from our 42nd representation, but I am going to give a shout out to Luann and to Brian, because they actually always do get back to us, so I want to give them the credit that they do. But in regards to everyone else, it's been very limited on the response. I will say that we get much more response from our 40th district representatives, so it's kind of been a mixed response, I would say.
Well, one of the things, and I think Tim was starting to kind of angle towards this earlier when he said, speak towards the representation. I mean, we're talking maybe in sort of cloaked terms about Republican Party and Democratic Party, but really there's a whole other faction, and that is, regardless of party, nobody's representing Bellingham.
I agree with you. And, you know, that is something that actually kind of bothers me, to be honest. And I want to be absolutely inclusive to the county, because a majority of the 42nd is in Whatcom County, and it's important that everyone is included. However, there's only a teeny limited amount of the city, but in the 40th and in the 42nd, we do not have one single representative from Bellingham. We are the largest population in both of those districts, and we have not had a representative from Bellingham for a long time. And I really think that's important.
Right. And I guess what I was getting at in that particular question is that the Republican team that is operating in Olympia, that represents the 42nd district, have focused almost exclusively on rural issues. But it's not just Bellingham. It's Linden, Ferndale, Everson, Sumas, Blaine. There are cities inside the 42nd district. Are they getting the attention they need, do you think, from their 42nd district representatives?
Well, I would say that from my impression, it has been very cherry-picked on what they actually want to represent or the cities that they want to represent. So I have talked to other mayors and other city council members, and there are mixed feelings about the representation that they're getting from the 42nd.
And I just want to remind you that you are listening to Pinky Vargas, candidate Pinky Vargas. She is running against Doug Erickson. If he declares again, who knows what the man will do. But she's running for state senate position in the 42nd this year. And you are listening to KMRE, 102.3 FM Bellingham, 102.5 KAVZ in Deming and Van Zandt. I'm Stephanie Contouris. Tim Johnson and Dave Willingham also in the room with me. And Tim asked an important question about other cities, and I started to think about how some of us get irritated with the primariness of King County and how King County seems to kind of direct Washington State. Could the same be said for Bellingham? Like when Tim asks about these other cities, Ferndale, Acme, Alger, all of these other cities, is somebody from Bellingham the right person to represent smaller towns?
Well, I mean, I think the same could be said about whether a person in the rural county is the right representative to represent those cities. I grew up on a farm, and I work out in the county. It's my job. So it's not like I'm not familiar with the county, and I'm not familiar with the challenges and the issues they face. So I think I'm as qualified as anybody else.
Well, let me just, because we just spoke with Rosalinda Guillen, and you just said you worked on a farm, I'm going to give you the opportunity to weigh in on what happened with the LNI report, and what can we do, what do you want to see done to work harder to protect our workers and our immigrant workers?
You know, I was thinking about that earlier as I was listening to Rosalinda. I'm like, what can I do? And I'm going to ask her that exact question. How can I support them? I think partly, you know, making sure that people feel safe and heard right here is vitally important. But what I can actually do to support her, I'm going to ask her that question.
Go ahead.
Oh, sorry. Well, while we're talking about that particular industry, you know, I've said on the show many times that the one thing I do give Doug Erickson credit for, is I think he's been an exceptional advocate for a particular kind of industry, which is the petrochemical industries out at Cherry Point. And you have some experience in energy as well. Can you comment on that? Can you comment on what you would do as a representative of those Cherry Point industries?
Sure. So I will say right off the bat, these are really valuable jobs that contribute hugely to our community. And I don't want anybody to think because I care about the environment, that means I want to shut down these jobs. That's unrealistic. I do care about the environment. I do care about what our long-term plans are and how we're going to fix the problems that we have. I do want us to move towards 100% renewable energy. I also know that that's not going to happen tomorrow. And part of that is transition. And part of that is working with the existing facilities that we have now that run on petroleum. So we need the jobs. We still need the petroleum. And in the future, we can move towards more renewable energy. But I don't think it should be a just like stop everything, because our society would stop as we exist right now.
And how is it you know these things?
Well, I also work for the utility.
Fair
so
enough.
I work for Puget Sound Energy. That's right. And and I do energy efficiency, and I work with business accounts. So yes, I also am very clear on all the regulation that they have to follow.
So the other big elephant in the room question. Last year, the state's legislature dramatically overhauled the way we pay for education in this state. And the way they did so was by accepting the Republicans in the state Senate's demand that it be by increasing property tax, by transferring that authority from local school districts to the state itself, and which turned into a $13 billion statewide property tax increase. And I think it's important to bring this up now because people are just about to get their property tax bills under it. How do you feel about this, and do you think we need to do something different?
Well, I think you're referring to House Bill 2242, and which I will say that it is often a message from Republicans that they don't want to increase taxes. However, it was a Republican bill that pushed this through, which really is the largest property tax increase in our state history. And to front load it and have everyone have to pay that on their property taxes right now, I think is unacceptable. It's not fair that we have to pull that weight right now. So I think that that absolutely could have been done differently.
So do you think that there was an insidious motive with them doing that in so that come next election, if it passed, even if they brought it to the forefront, then they're like, this Democratic Olympia, and we need to get rid of these candidates. I mean, I'm just saying I've seen that before.
So I can't speak to their strategy, but I think we can watch it unfold. Because it will.
Really, no opinion. Come on, no opinion at all.
Well, it is ironic because I do know, based on the Elway poll, that the Republicans are going to run on a tax platform. And it's very ironic that they created the tax increase that now they're going to rail against. And we had talked about that, whether any of them were going to actually campaign for the levy shift that they had
right.
proposed. What's your view on taxes? Pinky.
Period.
Well, my view on taxes, period, is that really, I think we're all paying a lot of taxes. And, you know, even right now, we have another bill in regards to help with our school funding. And so I think a lot of this weight falling on the people who live here, who are paying an incredible amount of taxes, is unfair. I actually think we need to do a better job of managing the money that's actually happening in Olympia, and figure out what is it that is, why can't we fund certain things? I know that last year the state the budget committee talked about getting rid of a lot of the loopholes in our tax system right now, and a lot of them could not get through. So I think that's a great place for us to start, is figure out what can we actually close loopholes in, and instead of raising people's taxes, because people are really heavily burdened right now.
Candidate Pinky Vargas, I have to say I disagree with you. I mean, it's all about context, right? If you look at any other developed nation in the world, we're not paying very much taxes. It feels like we're paying a lot of taxes. But compared to a lot of developed countries, the amount of taxes that we pay is really not that much. What frustrates me is how regressively taxed.
Oh, I
we
agree
are.
With that.
So I got to ask, where are you on a state income tax?
So I will say, okay, so first of all, when I say certain things, like, one, I want to look at where we're spending our money right now. So I don't say let's bring in more before we actually know what we're doing with the money that we have right now. I think we have an incredibly regressive tax system, and I would like to see that be the focus. And if that was our focus, then we could actually look and see what we need to do.
So you can't come out right now and say that you support or oppose a state income tax?
I can't, actually, because I really think that I don't know all the intricacies of what are happening in our tax bill right now. And without saying that, I can't make a really clear definition of what I think I should do for moving forward.
But we do know it's regressive. And if
we,
could sales tax less and property tax less, it seems like a step in the right direction.
It does. I agree with you.
So less than a month left in the session. In Olympia, you talked about a couple of things. What is your bill? What is the one that you are following, hoping for the most to see enacted into law?
Well, equal pay for equal work is really important to me. And I will point out that both of our House representatives from the 42nd voted nay, which is really disappointing.
Tell us a little bit more about that bill.
So I will tell you that right now, I'm sure people are aware, but women are often only paid about 77 cents on the dollar compared to what men make. And let's see, I do have that bill number in front of me. I did write it down because sometimes it's not so easy to remember what all the bills are. Here we go. House Bill 1506. And I will say that 19 other Republicans did vote to support this, but our two from the 42nd did not, and it is now moved over to the Senate, and hopefully that'll be passed soon. I'm sorry, you asked me more about the bill itself. So the bill itself is ensuring that things like, for example, if a woman leaves the workforce for a little while and she was maybe making a certain salary, and then allowing an employer is allowed to go find out what her old salary was, and then she could maybe be missing out just because she took either a gap, or maybe she was underpaid for her last job, and then the employer at this time right now can say, well, that's all you earned last time, why should I be paying you more? So if we take those things out of the equation, then there is more opportunity for people to actually get paid for the job they do.
Well, following on Dave's question a little bit, you know, when people run for office, they usually have like a particular thing they want to focus on, and obviously, when you are elected, you become a generalist and you have to deal with many, many things. But Chris Litton, for example, her thing was education. Mm-hmm. Kevin Ranker's thing was, you know, the health of Puget Sound and Salish Sea. When Doug Erickson ran, he actually ran as the conservative environmentalist, if you can believe that. But that was his particular focus. You know, I think that Lou Anne Van Werven, when she ran, she was really interested in higher education and looking at Western Washington. What's the thing that really excites you the most, and the thing that you would like to go down to Olympia and make great strides on?
Well, I actually have two things. The environment is actually really important to me in regards to how we're moving forward and what we're going to do, and ensuring we have things like we have a great company here, iTech, who manufactures solar panels. I mean, making sure that we are supporting renewable energy and actually getting it to us that place we want to in the future sooner than that's a big part for me. But also a huge personal part for me is issues around civil rights. And if you look at last week, Senator Erickson voted for a conversion therapy bill.
Right.
And
which is what?
Which is would allow a parent to
it's my understanding that the bill was to make it not legal anymore for parents to mandate children who
under
are
18.
LGBTQ
yeah.
be forced into conversion therapy, which is supposed to un-gay young people.
Yeah.
And so I don't think it was a bill for it. I think it was a bill to...
He was voting against. He wanted to keep the provision to allow parents to be able to mandate their children take conversion therapy. So thank you for that clarification. But these things, they get under my skin really bad. I can't believe in today's day and age that we are not supporting people to be whoever they want to be. And make whatever choices they want to make. And I think as long as you're not hurting other people, you should be allowed to be exactly who you want to be and make whatever choices you want.
Well, it's so much fun to grill you. And obviously, we ourselves should be a candidate panel because we all find ourselves to be experts at that here at Cascadia News Now. But there's so many legislative bills, and they're happening so fast because we have a powerhouse in Olympia. So I do want to spend some time on our show actually talking about some of the things that are happening, other than the ones that Pinky's mentioned. So, Dave, do you want to start with an overview?
Well, I want to mention just at the beginning that Kevin Ranker, 40th senator, today dropped a giant omnibus tax bill, and it's large. And I haven't gotten very far into it, but the headline item, the item I saw the state Republicans were responding to immediately, was it would remove the sales tax exemption for candy. So candy would become taxed, and that would have the side effect of candy would no longer be purchasable with SNAP, with food stamp benefits. So thanks, Kevin, for dropping that right before the show.
Intentional, I'm sure.
Yeah, it's been, you know, like Pinky was saying, it's been bonkers this week because we just passed the the deadline to get things out of committee and onto the floor if they're going to survive. You know, so we're going to be seeing a lot more of Senator Ranker's ORCA bill. A new Voter Rights Act is moving its way through, which would open a legal avenue for people to challenge local, like countywide voting instead of district based. And Tim, this is something that I know you have strong feelings about, but this is partially in response to a couple of years ago now, some Yakima residents successfully sued the city because they used a at-large voting system that prevented their 40% Latino population from actually getting representation.
And so it does
help people who are in certain constituencies, definitely people of color, but not exclusively, to be more equally represented. I think one of the things that this bill does is automatically registers people to vote. Is that the deal? And so therefore, right now you have a very disproportionate level of registered voters who are white, who are upper class, who have completed doctorates. And so theoretically, if everyone just is automatically registered to vote when they're a citizen, when they get their driver's license, then that should up the proportions of people who can vote.
Right. And I just want to give a shout out that the Democrats and the I love it when this happens. So I just want to give a shout out to it. But the Democrats and the Republicans seem to have tumbled to the idea that people's access to the internet is a nonpartisan issue and that they may be able to get together and draft some bills that provide some protection on the issue of net neutrality. So I just want to praise that.
And maybe you should go to the Cascadia Weekly, and maybe you should read Tim Johnson's Gristle, because he says a lot about net neutrality this week.
Yeah, and there's an internet privacy bill that is finally starting to move in the Senate that would protect people from their internet service provider. It does not protect you from any of the other threat vectors.
What could my internet service provider do to me, Dave?
Call you up on the phone and pester you to buy more.
They could, you know, they have access to all of your traffic. Mm-hmm. They can see everything that they've got. They've got slightly more access than Facebook and Google do now, and that's terrifying.
Okay. So one of the things that I think is super, super important, and Pinky, you brought up civil rights and civil justice, is House Bill 2951. And this addresses the epidemic of Native American women in our state who are murdered or who disappear. And what this bill would do, it increases the reporting and investigation of missing Native American women in our state, and calls for specific studies. But the other thing this bill does, and I feel hopeful and dubious at the same time about this, but it mandates an increase of shared information between state, federal, and tribal agencies. And without those agencies talking to each other, cases disappear.
I think that's fantastic. That was modeled after, if I recall correctly, one of the first steps that led to the Ontario Truth and Reconciliation Commission that actually started sitting down with their First Nations people to talk about, you know, we know this was a bad situation, this is a bad situation, how do we move forward together? So that would be a great step to see in the state.
And moving on, I know that we have barely scratched the surface. If nobody's jumping up, let's get into the death penalty bill, because that is something I care very deeply about. I can't believe that states like Illinois, and there are states that are more to the red than we are, that have abolished the death penalty, and we haven't. Thank you, Governor Inslee. He's put a moratorium on it. Here's what I know about the bill. I know that there were some different versions. Some people wanted an exemption for people who murder police officers. Anybody want to jump on that?
Yeah, that's a bad idea.
Thank you. Why do you think so? Pinky, do you think that's a bad idea?
I do think it's a bad idea.
Yeah, how come?
Well, I think that we have to have the same standard for everybody. And I don't think that we should be putting people to death, period.
And where are we? Oh, go ahead.
Well, and just to, the state should not, the government should not be able to kill its people under any circumstances, and that's my, you know, crazy libertarians talking, but, you know, that should be something that is impossible and unthinkable. And, you know, this worship of, you know, police officers like there's some sort of special, you know, snowflake class that need extra special love and protection is absurd and infantilizing and beneath the dignity of their role in our society.
Yeah, I guess how I feel about it, I find it kind of fascinating because I think this is one of these public opinion issues that is just evolving in time with actually very little pressure behind it. I mean, it used to be very, very, very important to Americans to have a death penalty. It's becoming less and less and less so. And it's not even being, I think, robustly defended at any level nationally because it's being demonstrated that it's not a deterrent to anything, you know, except, I suppose, repeat offenders. I suppose if there's a death penalty, you don't have repeat offenders in murder. I guess that's mm-hmm. You might be able to say that, and I say that somewhat ironically, hopefully humorously, but just this, the entire frame of that discussion is changing in ways that other things in our society have also changed. But that one is moving in slow motion. I think one of the reasons why it's not a big deal in Washington is we just don't have that many people on death row that it's an issue for. I honestly think that. You know, in Texas where they're on a conveyor belt, it's an issue. Mm. In Illinois where they're on a conveyor belt. But it's in the background in Washington, and I think part of that is because we don't have that many people sitting on death row.
That is a horrific and accurate metaphor, Tim. Mm-hmm.
Can I say one more thing
about
that, Cessna?
Yeah, of course.
So the death penalty has never been a deterrent. And for us to think it is ridiculous. I have great respect for the Bellingham Police Department. I think we're really lucky. I don't think every city's as lucky as we are. And in saying that, there are a lot of people to say that a police officer's life is more valuable than somebody whose life was taken from a police officer is unjust. And so I just wanted to say that.
And yet, I think that there's an argument that it is not about deterrent. I mean, deterrent is one of the things that comes up. But there are people who believe that it is fair retribution when somebody commits a heinous crime.
Yeah, and what's interesting about that, though, is there are families, even in Washington, I've read their reports, who they don't support – they have a family member who has been killed. They don't support the death penalty because it's this arduous path that gets this person again and again and again in front of the media. It denies justice and closure to their families again and again. And in the end, it's a very vacuous closure. And it's a very empty closure for a lot of these people. It's like, you know, I waited 25 years for this person to finally be executed, and they were executed, and it's like,
yeah,
I feel nothing beneficial from that process.
And over the course of that person's, you know, life from the time they are arrested, they're going to cost the state an extra average of $1 million in appeals and court costs.
Correct.
and the maintenance of the mechanisms to murder people is a moral stain on our state. Moratorium or not, we have the, you know, mechanisms in our state for the state to execute citizens, and that's unacceptable, and we need to, you know, free up the resources we are spending on that.
And Dave, you talked about earlier the Ottawa Truth and Reconciliation Commission and reconciliation, whole other show, but reconciliation as an alternative to retribution is growing in this country. And man, anything we can do to support that. Again, we'll be following that and we'll get into that more in future shows. But before we move on, I do want to mention a couple of pretty awesome bills in terms of students. One is the Student Loan Bill of Rights, which protects students from college debt, and the Free College Act, which would provide free tuition for lower and lower middle class. Anybody want to say something?
Yeah, I'll jump in on that. There was a very interesting economic study that came out this week that showed And it's like if you're somebody that looks down the road, it was an alarming study that said that student loan debt is going to be a tremendous drag on our economy in the future because people are not going to be able to buy cars, they're not going to be able to buy homes, they're not going to be able to raise families because they are carrying this debt load. And so that if you can do some debt relief on that, you actually will free up money for our economy in the long run.
And we'll be happy to track those as well. One bill that's not getting a whole lot of attention, but our own 40th Representative Chris Litton has been working on, is the Washington House B&O tax relief bill. And let's hear from Chris on that.
Businesses are struggling across our state. And what I hear over and over is their struggle with paying B&O, that it's an unfair tax because it taxes on the gross instead of taking into consider what it actually costs to run a business.
That's State Representative Christine Litton. The Anacortes Democrat chairs the House Finance Committee, and this week she introduced legislation that would eliminate the B&O tax for 80% of the businesses in Washington state. Another 14 would pay what they currently do, and the top 6%, which includes some of the biggest businesses not just in Washington or the U.S., but the world, would see a surcharge on their taxes. Litton says her bill is revenue neutral, meaning the total revenue would be the same, but thousands of small businesses would suddenly see a boost in their bottom line.
This is really about small business entrepreneurs trying to start up, and helping our communities be successful.
Litton's bill, officially dubbed the Small Business Tax Fairness Act, could go before the full House within a few days. In Olympia, I'm Dan Frizzell.
That piece comes to us via the Washington House Democrats. You're listening to Cascadia News Now with our guest, candidate Pinky Vargas, Dave Willingham, me, Stephanie Contouris, and Tim Johnson.
Well, I just have to say quickly on the business and occupation tax, it is one of the most onerous taxes in Washington. It's one of the most unpopular taxes in Washington. It's probably one of the most unfair taxes in Washington because you have to pay on the net of your income. It doesn't matter what your business expenses are. And so any kind of reform in that area, I think, is a good direction and will be very popular in the long run.
Okay, we've got 2 minutes left. Dave,
all right,
go.
One comment on the Voter Bill of Rights that I wanted to make sure we got out, especially since we have a candidate here. You know, we've worked on electoral stuff in the past, those of us around the table. Automatically registering voters takes at least 30% of the work that is currently being done in campaigns and frees that up for actual issue work.
Remember that, Pinky. And you said you had a comment.
I did. You know, you asked kind of like what some of my priorities were. And one of the things we just kind of talked about, and that's criminal justice. And I can say that I have been getting a huge education over the last couple of years dealing with the jail issues. And I would really like to put as much effort into criminal justice reform and keeping people out of jail. So that is very important to me.
Fantastic. And what we did not get to tonight is Billingham's school bond, $155 million for three schools in North Billingham, but also other projects throughout the city. Go and look it up. Vote Tuesday, February 13th. You have been listening to Cascadia News Now. Huge thanks to our guests, Rosalinda Guillen and Pinky Vargas, our co-hosts, Dave Willingham and Tim Johnson, and me, Stephanie Contouris. Our fantastic engineer, Devlin Sweeney, carries the day. Find us on Facebook, Cascadia News Now. If you'd like to respond, we have our archives, and you can also respond on CascadiaNewsNow.com. You have been listening to Cascadia News Now on KAVZ 102.5 in Deming, Van Zandt, and KMRE 102.3 FM, Bellingham.